disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please consider supporting us. Head over to www.deadsoulspodcast.com and see how you can donate to our research and investigations and find other ways to support us. We really appreciate you stopping by. You can also find us over on Instagram if that's more your thing. Just search Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. As always, thank you for joining us. When people ask, who is the worst serial killer of all time, or who committed the most heinous crimes in history, it's hard to provide a universally accepted answer. After all, once you arrive at a certain degree of criminality, the lines of severity can and often do become subjective. There are some names, though, known the world over, that will almost always gain agreement as being deserving on any list which discusses the worst serial killers in the history of the Western world. One of those names is John Wayne Gacy. You may know him as the Killer Clown. Gacy raped, tortured, and murdered at least 33 young males over an 11-year period between 1967 to 1978. His victims, for the most part, were killed in Cook County, Illinois. Gacy is often referred to as the Killer Clown due to his alter ego as Pogo and Patches the Clown, a persona he liked to take on when he performed at children's hospitals and charitable events within his community of Norwood Park Township. Tonight we're going to take a look at the life of John Wayne Gacy, from his abusive childhood to his infamous and depraved crimes. Unlike most serial killers, Gacy wasn't a strange or lonely character, to the likes of Jeffrey Dahmer or Albert Fish, for example. He was instead a hard-working and sociable member of the community, and a Democratic Party precinct captain. For many years, Gacy fooled friends, neighbors, and relatives into believing that he was a respectable businessman and charitable and concerned community member who helped those in need. The actual and stark reality was that Gacy was a predatory pedophile, serial murderer, and sadistic torturer who preyed on boys and young men for his sexual gratification. Gacy tortured and killed his victims in the most abhorrent ways before burying their bodies in the crawl space beneath his house. A list of information about the dates and circumstances of his crimes came from Gacy himself through his confessions. But, as seems to be the standard among serial killers, Gacy was also a compulsive liar. So there is some inconsistency within his stories, and some dates and names may differ depending on the source. After wading through the evidence and a number of well-researched works, I'm going to try and bring an accurate portrayal of one of the United States' most infamous serial killers. I'm going to be referencing the work of Terry Sullivan and his book Killer Clown, John Wayne Gacy Murders. Sullivan was the assistant state's attorney in the trial of Gacy and ran the prosecution team which secured Gacy's guilty sentence. If you're interested in this case, I highly recommend this book. John Stanley Gacy was of Polish and Danish ancestry. He served in the First World War before beginning a career as an auto repair machinist. In 1938, John Stanley Gacy married Marion Elaine Robinson, and the couple settled in Chicago. Not long after they wed, they welcomed their first child, a daughter named Joanne, born in November 1939. Shortly after, on March 17, 1942, they welcomed a second child, a boy they named John Wayne Gacy. He was born at 12:29 a.m. at Edgewater Hospital in Chicago. Karen, their third and final child, joined them in 1945. Chicago was a tough place back then, and organized crime was widespread. Even today, it has the reputation as being one of the most violent cities in the United States, with a higher proportion of gun crime and homicides compared to other large cities. The Gacy family lived in a well-kept house on the north side of Chicago, where Gacy Jr. and his sisters attended the local Catholic school. When John was 11 years old, the family moved and he started attending grammar school, where he initially performed well. He had friends, a part-time job, and attended Boy Scout meetings, all of which made him appear to be a normal and well-adjusted boy. John Gacy, however, developed a few health problems following an incident when he was 11 years old, where he had hit his head on a swing. Following this, he started suffering occasional blackouts and was eventually diagnosed with a blood clot on the brain. Fortunately for Gacy, the clot was successfully treated with medication. Gacy had an operation at age 15 to remove his appendix and also needed to take medication for a heart problem that he would suffer with for the rest of his life. Gacy avoided all sports and exercise due to this heart condition and was an overweight child, which only exasperated the situation. He was an average student and didn't stand out in any subject nor socially. He merely blended with the crowd. During Gacy's teenage years, he changed high school 4 times, but would never complete his senior year or graduate. The final school he attended was the Charles A. Prosser Academy in the Belmont Cragin neighborhood of Chicago. Fellow students noted that he seemed troubled. Following sporadic and patchy attendance, Gacy eventually dropped out. He later admitted that he dropped out due to his relationship with his father, which caused him great difficulty and distress. John Sr. was a drunk and a bully, and the entire family would suffer from his violent outbursts. He beat his wife and would terrorize his daughters. John Jr. was repeatedly belittled and verbally abused. He would call him dumb, stupid, and compare him to his sisters. The constant berating had a profound impact on John Jr. His early childhood memories were not filled with love and fun like other children and his peers. They were instead full of verbal abuse, nastiness, and wicked beatings. John Gacy, however, had a close relationship with his mother and both of his sisters. His mother affectionately called him Johnny. His mother did her best to shield her son from his father's abuse, but their intervention would often fuel John Sr.'s anger even more, and he would accuse Gacy of being a sissy, mama's boy, and a degenerate homosexual. Despite this brutality, Gacy said that he loved his father and yearned to have a proper father-son relationship. He tried in vain to please his father and earn his approval. Gacy's relationship with his father hit an all-time low when he was around 7 years old. John Sr. had found out that John Jr. and another boy had inappropriately touched a young girl. John Sr. whipped and beat his son mercilessly as punishment. In 1949, at around the same time that this beating occurred, John Jr. started being sexually abused by a family friend who would molest John in his truck. Gacy was so scared that his father would find out and blame him for the abuse that he told no one until many years later, allowing it to continue. Following a particularly brutal encounter with his father, Gacy left home and headed west, ending up in Las Vegas. He quickly found work as a janitor at the Palm Mortuary. The owner said that he was a good worker, remained focused, and got on with his job. But John just wanted to earn money, enough to go back home. Gacy later admitted that one evening, while alone in the morgue, he climbed into a coffin of a deceased teenage boy and hugged, caressed, and fondled the body. He said that he realized what he had done, though, and became disgusted with himself. The incident prompted Gacy to call his mother and ask whether his father would allow him to come back home. His father agreed, and he drove back to Chicago the very same day. John Jr. was warmly welcomed by everyone when he arrived back home, with the exception, of course, of his father, John Sr. He was indifferent about his return and showed little interest or concern. After returning home, Gacy enrolled at Northwestern Business College, and though he had failed to graduate from high school, Gacy graduated Northwestern in 1963 and celebrated with his family, minus his father. Following his graduation, Gacy took a trainee managerial position at the Nunn's Bush Shoe Company. The company was so impressed with him that in 1964, just before his 22nd birthday, the company transferred Gacy to Springfield, Illinois to manage the company's retail outlet. Gacy was perfect for the job and a fantastic employee. He was a naturally good speaker and conversationalist, and his gregarious personality made him an exceptional salesman. Shortly after his transfer, he began dating Marilyn Myers, one of his co-workers, and within a few months, they were engaged to be married. They wed in September of 1964. Apart from Gacy's increase in weight gain, which aggravated his heart condition more, things worked out well between him and Marilyn. Gacy was well respected within the community, and the couple were financially secure. For all intensive purposes, the future looked bright for the new family. In February 1966, Marilyn gave birth to their first child, a son who they named Michael. The following year, the couple welcomed a daughter who they named Christine. Gacy would describe this period of his life as perfect, and said that after the children were born, he had finally earned his father's approval. In July 1966, his father actually apologized to John Jr. for the abuse he laid upon him as a child in an unexpected turn of events. John Jr. was elated. While living in Springfield, John discovered the United States Junior Chamber, also known as the JCs, a group for young and developing male business professionals and civic-minded individuals within the community. The group was for males aged 18 to 40. They regularly celebrated their successes through a succession of dinner and banquet ceremonies. The extremely sociable Gacy reveled in the group. He had always craved recognition and appreciation, something he never received from his father, and now he got it with this organization. Gacy soon rose through the ranks of the JCs and would work tirelessly for them, ensuring he maintained that recognition and reputation. In 1965, he was elected the first vice president and the JCs' Outstanding Man of the Year. Gacy's father-in-law offered him a job managing a string of KFC franchises, which he owned in Waterloo, Iowa. Whilst Marilyn's parents never liked Gacy, by offering him the job, it meant that their daughter and grandson would be close to them. Marilyn's parents had actually tried to persuade her not to marry Gacy right up until the day of the marriage itself. Gacy was never aware of this. The family moved into a small but well-maintained bungalow in a nice part of town. Job one for Gacy was to join the Waterloo branch of the JCs. They were happy to quickly accept another chapter's Man of the Year into their ranks. To the outside world and to those looking in, the Gacys were the perfect family. They were respectable, hard-working, and financially stable. Fred Myers, John's father-in-law, had a different opinion of his son-in-law, however. He wasn't particularly happy with the way that he ran his restaurants and how John would pompously lord over the staff as if he was the owner. Fred also hated John giving away free food to his friends and JC members when they came by. Fred was often angry with John, and if he wasn't his son-in-law, he would have fired him, he later said. Gacy relished in his new life and living in Waterloo, not least because the JC's social life offered a slightly more exciting activity. Prostitution, pornography, and a number of other vice-related activities. Wife-swapping was the norm amongst the group too. Gacy reveled in his newfound debauchery and bragged about the women that he slept with to other JC members. His relationship with his wife grew distant, however, and he began to offer her sexually to other men and friends of his, embracing the wife-swapping culture within the Waterloo JCs. He was keeping Marilyn purposefully short of money, something her parents couldn't understand given his well-paid management role. Gacy joined the Merchant Patrol, a localized and volunteer private security force which residents set up to guard their premises against break-ins and other crime. It was a sort of neighborhood watch scheme. He did night patrols in his car and used a portable red flashing light on his car's roof, making it seem like a faux police vehicle. Gacy had an ego and a high opinion of self-worth. He would often take some of his young male employees with him on his night patrols, trying to impress them. Gacy's wife Marilyn later said that her husband had a fascination with the police and emergency vehicles, and liked to think he had an influence over the emergency services. He would often take free KFC meals to firefighters and patrol officers, and began to refer to himself as Colonel John Gacy. Most of the people he gave free food to appreciated it, but a few thought he was trying to buy friends, buy respect and influence within the community. In particular, some noted that John liked to impress teenage boys especially. It wasn't unusual to see Gacy with a teenage boy beside him in his patrol car. No one ever really thought anything negative of it, however, as KFC hired a lot of young staff members, as was the nature of the job. There was no reason to suspect John Gacy of anything untoward, other than having a big ego, of course. Eventually, however, some of the staff at KFC began commenting that it was only good-looking boys that he was offering a ride to. Staff whispers turned to rumours about their boss's sexual interest in young boys, and some staff started to decline a ride from John, avoiding Gacy as much as they could. The staff also told how Gacy would deliberately splash some boys with hot cooking oil so that he could take them to the hospital in his truck. Despite the rumours, there was enough JCs and friends of Gacy's who believed that John was a good and charitable man. Gacy was named the JC's most outstanding vice president in 1967, for example. He was also honoured as the best JC club chaplain in the state of Iowa, and he looked set to take the top role of club president. Well done for John. By 1968, Gacy had two young children, and some dubious encounters and local rumours aside, John and Marilyn seemed happy. He had decided to hand his notice in to his father-in-law and start up his own business. Things were certainly on the up and up. Then there was a knock on the door that would shatter things for John. He answered the door to a policeman who informed him that he had been indicted for molesting young boys. The policeman produced a search warrant and seized from the family home 5 rolls of obscene 8mm movie footage and an envelope containing advertisements for pornographic material. Marilyn was in complete shock. She had no idea her husband harboured sexual preferences towards young boys. She believed entirely in his reputation as a good, hard-working man, loving father and upstanding member of the community. Marilyn was sure the police had made a mistake. But the allegations against Gacy were made by 2 boys who told the jury that on separate occasions, Gacy coerced them into unwanted sexual encounters with him. James Tilleri, a 16-year-old who worked for Gacy at KFC, stated that Gacy invited him into his home while Gacy's wife was in hospital giving birth to their second child. Gacy and Tilleri watched pornography and drank alcohol before Gacy propositioned the boy. Tilleri initially refused his sexual advances, but Gacy forced the boy at knife point up to the bedroom. Gacy cut the youth with a knife, but hadn't wanted to go that far and backed off and apologised, agreeing to drive the boy home. The second accusation came from Donald Voorhees, a 15-year-old boy who Gacy knew through his father, who was a fellow member of the JCs. Voorhees did odd jobs for Gacy on occasion, and Gacy had told him that he was conducting scientific research for a sexual education committee. Gacy told Voorhees that he could earn $50 if he assisted him in his research. Over a period of several months, Gacy forced Voorhees to commit mutual oral sex with him. He got the boy drunk and in a variety of locations assaulted him. The boy became very confused about what was happening to him, as Gacy told him that his scientific research had to be kept a secret. Gacy told Voorhees that if he did tell anyone about what was happening, he would contact his gangster friend from Chicago. Gacy denied the allegations the boys made, although he did fail a police polygraph test. Many people in the community, including the JCs, believed that he was being framed. Eventually, however, Gacy admitted to having a paid relationship with Voorhees. Despite the admission, nothing much happened. Gacy had a lot of incriminating evidence against the police involving the darker and criminal side of the JCs, which had on its membership a number of the local police. On August the 30th, 1968, Gacy persuaded 18-year-old Russell Schroeder, an employee of his, to physically assault Donald Voorhees in an attempt to prevent him from testifying against him. Gacy paid Schroeder $300, and Schroeder lured Voorhees to an isolated country park and sprayed mace in his eyes, then severely beat him. Voorhees managed to escape, however, and immediately reported the assault to police, identifying Schroeder as his attacker. They arrested him the following day, and he confessed to assaulting Voorhees at Gacy's paid request. Police charged Gacy with hiring the boy to assault and intimidate Voorhees. He was jailed in lieu of a $10,000 bond. He also underwent a psychiatric evaluation and was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. Doctors stated that he was a sociopath and a psychopath, but fit to stand trial. On November 7, 1968, Gacy pleaded guilty to one count of sodomy concerning boys, but not guilty to the charges relating to other youths. Gacy claimed Voorhees had offered himself to him and that he had acted out of curiosity. However, his story was disbelieved in court, and he was convicted of sodomy on December 3rd and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment to be served at the Anamosa State Penitentiary. Gacy was given the maximum possible sentence at the time, and the judge who sentenced him acknowledged the danger Gacy posed to young boys and set him the maximum possible sentence that he could, a sentence which would have been 25 years had it been today. The same day Gacy was convicted, his wife petitioned for divorce, requesting that she be awarded the couple's home and sole custody of their two children, plus alimony. The court agreed and ruled in her favour, and the divorce was finalised on September 18, 1969. Marilyn agreed to provide Gacy with photos of the children twice a year at his expense. Gacy, however, never requested any photos of the children, nor did he make any contact with Marilyn or the children ever again. During his incarceration, Gacy rapidly gained a reputation as a model prisoner. He had risen to the position of head cook within a matter of months after his arrival. He also joined the inmate JC chapter, and increased its membership from 50 to 650 men in less than 18 months. John, they said, could convince an Eskimo to buy ice from him. Gacy took the role of prisoner union leader upon himself too, and is known to have secured an increase in the inmates' daily pay and also to have supervised several projects aimed to improve conditions for the prisoners. Additionally, he managed the installation of a mini golf course in the prison recreational yard, quite the achievement at the time, guards would later state. On Christmas Day 1969, John's father died from cirrhosis of the liver. When he was told of the news, Gacy crumpled to the floor, sobbing uncontrollably. His request for supervised compassionate leave to attend the funeral was denied. Due to Gacy's status as a model prisoner, on the 18th of June 1970, however, he was released from jail on parole after serving just 18 months of his 10-year sentence. He was greeted upon his release by longtime friend Charlie Hill. Hill was one of the few people from Waterloo who believed in Gacy's innocence, and during his incarceration was his only regular visitor. Gacy moved back in with his mother and started working at a local restaurant. Continued his bragging and egotistical ways, telling his colleagues that he had served in the Marines. He also told his colleagues that he was a successful gambler and that he had worked as an ambulance driver. All of these stories were bullshit, of course. After working in several local restaurants, Gacy landed a job in a restaurant that was popular with members of Chicago's professional hockey team. It wouldn't be long before Gacy was plugging tickets for games and handing them out to his friends. His mother was pleased with how he had settled back in and agreed to help him buy a small house. Gacy moved to a quiet, family-orientated area at 8213 West Summerdale Avenue in Norwood Park. The house was sturdily built with a shingled front, a garage, and a small front and back lawn. Inside the house were two bedrooms and two extra rooms that had been added to the downstairs living area by the previous owner. In one of the bedrooms, there was a trapdoor that led to a 4-foot-deep crawl space beneath the house. In the extended part of the house, crawl spaces had been added, given that they were cheaper than adding a basement. As soon as Gacy moved in, he made renovations and alterations to the house. Neighbours would state after the fact that there was constant banging, sawing and DIY sounds coming from the house. Gacy installed a pool table and games machines, alongside a newly installed bar area that he kept well stocked with alcohol. The place gave off strong bachelor vibes. Far from being a reformed character, Gacy quickly turned into a predator, however. He started hanging around at the local Greyhound bus terminal at Clark and Randall Street in Chicago. Each day, thousands of passengers from all across the United States arrived in or traveled through the city. Some of them were just teenagers on their first trips without their parents. Young people arriving alone in the city made them very vulnerable, and pimps and perverts were often seen waiting to seduce young boys and girls into a life of prostitution or worse. It was the perfect place to pick up teenage boys for a deviant predator like Gacy. On February the 12th, 1971, barely 8 months after being released from prison, Chicago police charged Gacy with disorderly conduct after a teenage boy he picked up at the terminal made a complaint against him. The boy claimed that he was picked up by Gacy and taken back to his house, where he was forced to commit a sexual act. The case was dismissed, much to Gacy's luck, after the boy failed to attend court. Unbelievably, no one would hear about this accusation, not Gacy's neighbors, friends, or even the parole board who were meant to be monitoring him. So on October the 18th, 1971, Gacy was officially released from parole and his citizenship rights were entirely restored. The authorities had unknowingly released a monster into the world. John Wayne Gacy's first known murder occurred on January the 3rd, 1972, following a party that Gacy threw at his house. Following the party, Gacy drove to the Civic Center to view a display of ice sculptures, or so he said. In the early hours of the morning, he then persuaded a 16-year-old boy from the Greyhound bus terminal into his car. Timothy Jack McCoy was traveling from Michigan to Nebraska, and he took a break from the journey in Chicago. Gacy offered to take the teenager on a sightseeing tour of Chicago before driving him back to his home with the promise that he could spend the night there before continuing his journey the next day. Remember that it was the 1970s. The time period and culture was very different to what it is today. The young generation at that time were more free, and mass media fear and panic was not fed to the nation 24/7. You could argue that it was a more innocent time. Hitchhiking and hippie culture was widely accepted and normal amongst the youth, who generally didn't think twice about getting into a stranger's car, at least for the most part. Also, don't underestimate the persuasion, coercion, and confidence that Gacy held in his personal arsenal. There is a reason he achieved all that he did. Gacy later told various stories about how he came to kill McCoy, who initially became known as the Greyhound Busboy, as there was no identification for him at the time. Unlike most of Gacy's victims, the boy was not strangled. He was instead stabbed twice in the chest. After the killing, Gacy claimed that he sat and listened to the boy slowly dying and gasping for air. Gacy admitted that this caused him to have experienced a huge sexual high. It was at that point that he realized that for him, death was the ultimate sexual thrill. Gacy buried McCoy's body in the crawl space beneath his house, but later, when his second wife Carol moved in and complained of the odors in the house, he covered the body over with concrete. The remains of McCoy were not identified for 14 years after their discovery. Dental records eventually proved the body was that of 15-year-old Timothy Jack McCoy. Gacy didn't kill again until around 2 years after his initial thrill killing. In January 1974, Gacy would kill again, however. He strangled a young man and hid his body in a closet in his home before burying him. Gacy later said that bodily fluids leaked from the victim's mouth and nose, staining his carpet. As a result of this, Gacy would regularly stuff cloth rags or the victim's underwear into the mouth of his future victims. You really don't want to stain your carpet after all. His second victim has tragically never been identified. Despite having a preference for teenage boys, Gacy was often seen in the presence of Carol Hoff, a divorcee with two young daughters. Carol was a regular visitor to Gacy's house, and along with his mother, Gacy introduced her to his neighbours. She became a familiar face when the residents met up for card games and cocktail nights. Gacy had become a popular figure in the community once again, and was a helpful and considerate neighbour. Neighbours are on record as saying that they liked Gacy very much, and that he couldn't be more helpful if they needed anything. Their only negative was that it was considered unanimous that all the neighbours thought he had awful taste in home decor. His house, both inside and out, was full of garish colours that stood out against the more conservative houses in the area. This didn't stop his neighbours enjoying his company, though. He was very active in his local community, willingly loaned out his construction tools to friends and neighbours, and happily ploughed snow from neighbours' walks free of charge. He loved to host annual summer parties, which were attended by hundreds of people, including local politicians. Carol and John would eventually marry. Carol knew that John had been in prison, but he was so kind and considerate to her, she felt he could offer her and her daughters a stable life. Carol and her daughters, the neighbours and the community at large all thought John Wayne Gacy was a regular swell guy. There was one teeny tiny thing that concerned her though. John's erratic moods. One minute he was kind, loving, friendly and upbeat. The next he was in a furious rage. Although only a small concern, this didn't stop the marriage from going forward in July of 72. Carol and her kids moved into John's house the same day. Things started off just fine. Well, apart from that foul odour that could be smelled throughout the house. Carol thought that it smelled like rotten meat. John's mother-in-law also mentioned the stench, as did visiting neighbours. Gacy commented that it was a typical smell of damp beneath the house and tried to cover it with lime. So kind of lime and meat mojito. He also blocked up some of the vents to try and dampen the smell, but nothing really removed the odour. In an extraordinary twist to the story, Gacy was arrested shortly after his marriage to Carol. He was charged with aggravated battery and reckless conduct. As it became established, Gacy had posed as a police sheriff and forced the young man into his car under the threat of arrest. Gacy then forced the boy to perform oral sex on him. Luckily, the terrified boy managed to escape. The charges were later dropped, however, and the case never went to court. The youth was deemed as a witness with no credibility after it was found out that the young boy attempted to blackmail Gacy following the incident. Life continued on for the Gacys, and in 1974, John started hosting regular, huge, themed parties for friends and neighbours. During the parties, Gacy would brag about his achievements to anyone and everyone who would listen to him. Many friends and neighbours were getting wise to Gacy's tall tales, and they simply humoured him while he made claims about his days in the Marines, police and fire brigade, or his time as an ambulance driver. Humouring him, however, only led to his reputation as a harmless and friendly guy sinking into the psyche of the local community and made the harsh reality of who Gacy really was disappear further and further over the horizon. John Gacy had set up a small part-time company in 1971 called PDM Contractors. It stood for painting, decorating and maintenance. Initially, he undertook minor repair work in the evenings or on weekends, but he later expanded to include much bigger projects, such as interior design, remodeling and landscaping. In mid-1973, Gacy quit his job as a cook and committed full-time to his construction business. By 1975, PDM was rapidly growing, with Gacy working up to 16 hours per day. Gacy worked on multiple projects simultaneously and frequently travelled to other states. This is something to keep in the back of your mind now, as we'll come back to this later, by the way. By 1978, PDM's annual revenue was over $200,000, or around $935,000 in today's money. No small sum. While his business was booming, his marriage to Carol started to deteriorate. His temper was getting worse. And randomly, Gacy had decided to tell his wife that he was bisexual. He even went as far as to announce to Carol on Mother's Day in 1975, following the couple having sex, that he would never have sex with her again. If this wasn't bizarre enough, tension only got worse when Gacy started regularly going out late at night, often not returning until the next morning. When Carol asked him where he was going, he would tell her that it was none of her business. Trigger yet more temper tantrums from John. The odour in the house was also getting to be really unbearable, and Carol couldn't understand why her husband did nothing about it, and didn't seem affected by it. He just shoveled quicklime into the crawl space under the house, then went out. Admittedly, John was a good provider and hard worker, Carol thought, but she also quickly realised that she had married the wrong man. But she stuck it out for the sake of her girls, who by now referred to John as Daddy. Carol felt trapped in the marriage. The final straw for Carol was when she found evidence that John was meeting young men and viewing gay pornography. She also saw him bringing teenage boys into the garage late at night, and she finally reached her limit. In October 1975, the couple had a blistering argument. Carol asked John for a divorce. John agreed to his wife's request. Although by mutual consent, Carol continued to live at the house until February 1976, when she and her daughters would eventually move into their own apartment. On March the 2nd of that year, the Gacys' divorce was finalized upon the false grounds of John's infidelity with other women, apparently. Following their divorce, Carol remained in close contact with John, and the two got on much better than when they were married. In late 1975, John Gacy joined the Jolly Joker Clown Club, whose members regularly performed at fundraising events, parades, and volunteered to entertain hospitalized children. This was another way that Gacy could feed his ego and obtain easy admiration. Gacy created his own characters: Pogo the Clown, a happy clown who liked fun and frolics, and Patches the Clown, a more demure and serious character. He performed as both Pogo and Patches at numerous local parties, political functions, charitable events, and children's hospitals. Sometimes Gacy would remain in his clowning garb after a performance and drink at a local bar. This raised his profile even more locally, and he became well known and liked in the area even more. Little did the local townsfolk know that John Wayne Gacy wasn't merely entertaining local children as a clown. He was trying to gain access to young boys and lure those teenage boys back to his house or car to persuade, or if needs be, force them to engage in sexual acts with him. Pogo made Pennywise look like a Teletubby in comparison. Most of John's company's workforce at PDM Construction consisted of high school students and young men. They were cheap to hire, but also part of Gacy's sordid exploits. Gacy would often proposition his workers for sex or insist on sexual favors in return for lending his vehicles, financial assistance, or promotions. He also claimed to own many guns and once asked an employee, "Do you know how easy it would be to get one of my guns and kill you? And how easy it would be to get rid of your body?" John Butkovich was a hard-working 17-year-old boy who worked in a hardware store. Gacy regularly visited the store and took a liking to him, and he offered Butkovich a job at PDM. John enjoyed working for Gacy and worked long hours for a reasonable paycheck. If he was working late, he sometimes stayed over at Gacy's house. The relationship between Gacy and Butkovich soon soured as Gacy refused to pay him for 2 weeks of work that he had completed. Butkovich and a couple of friends visited Gacy's house on the evening of July 30th, 1975 to demand what he was owed, and an argument broke out on the front lawn. Gacy stated he saw off the boys and they left his property, and Butkovich subsequently dropped his friends off at their home in his Dodge. That evening, Butkovich didn't go home to his parents. This was highly unusual and out of character for him. The following day, his 1960 Dodge was found parked near the corner of Sheridan and Lawrence with his jacket and wallet still inside the vehicle and keys still in the ignition. John Butkovich's parents contacted the police and reported him missing immediately. They also contacted Gacy, who offered to help them with the search for him. Butkovich's parents quietly suggested that the police question Gacy over the disappearance. They knew that John and two friends had arrived at Gacy's house demanding the overdue pay. But it's what happened after that the Butkovich family were suspicious of. Gacy claimed that Butkovich must have simply ran away, which was out of character, but also absurd, the family thought. Over the following 3 years, John Butkovich's parents called the police more than 100 times, urging them to investigate John Wayne Gacy further. But they treated their son's disappearance as just another teenage runaway. It's truly devastating if you think what the family must have gone through with no one listening to their one simple request. The truth was, Gacy had encountered John exiting his car on the corner of South Lawrence Avenue, waving to attract his attention. According to Gacy, John approached his car declaring, "I want to talk to you." Gacy invited John into his car, then asked him back to his home, purportedly to discuss the issue over his overdue wages once again. Gacy got John drunk at his house, then conned him into allowing his wrist to be handcuffed behind his back in what John thought was a playful game. He then sat on his chest and strangled him. Gacy left John's body on his garage floor, intending to bury him later in the crawl space. But when his wife and stepdaughters returned home earlier than expected, Gacy buried John's body under the concrete floor of his garage instead. Following his divorce, but while his ex-wife and stepdaughters were still living with him, Gacy frequently went out late at night searching for young men to have sex with. It became a nightly ritual. He didn't kill everyone he had contact with, although the frequency of his killing increased after his wife finally moved out in 1976. His parties and late-night visitors became more frequent, and his neighbours couldn't help noticing that most of his guests were young teenage boys or young men. It also didn't go unnoticed that he spent a lot of time digging in his garden and renovating his property. His erratic behaviour did not initially concern his neighbours. They just thought of him as a little eccentric. But in reality, Gacy was at his most murderous, his most evil, his most psychopathic. He abducted and murdered at least 21 teenage boys and young men, with ages ranging from 14 to 28 years of age. Gacy had no trouble finding and befriending the boys. Many of them he hired to work with him at his ever-expanding business. He met others in bars and around the Greyhound bus station, many having travelled to the city to start new lives, find work, or were simply passing through. Gacy would lure the youngsters with promises of construction work or some other temptations. Gacy also befriended young boys when he performed in his clown attire for children's parties and charity events, such as 18-year-old Daryl Sampson. Gacy abducted and murdered Sampson, who was last seen alive in Chicago on April 6, 1976. He buried his body beneath the dining room with a section of cloth lodged down his throat. On the afternoon of May 14th, just a month later, 15-year-old Randall Reffert disappeared while walking home from high school. Hours after his abduction, 14-year-old Samuel Stapleton also vanished as he walked home from his sister's apartment. The boys were buried together in the crawl space beneath Gacy's house, and investigators believe both victims were murdered on the same evening, possibly together. A couple of weeks later, on June the 3rd, Gacy killed a 17-year-old Lakeview teenager named Michael Bonin. Michael had disappeared while traveling from Chicago, and Gacy had found him and strangled him with a ligature. Gacy liked to frequently cruise the streets of Uptown, searching for young boys who hung out on street corners selling themselves to middle-aged men. Shockingly, some of the kids were as young as 8 or 9 years old. Although Gacy's proclivity was usually teenage boys, Uptown Chicago in the 1970s was notorious for street prostitution and impoverished lives and living conditions. It was a place where the gay community was almost accepted in society, unlike in other parts of the United States, and Gacy felt comfortable there, mingling with other men who were mostly middle-aged and married men who had been forced to hide their sexuality, existing in the closet for years. The young street hustlers shared experiences of the men that they got into cars with and learned that a certain type of man enjoyed inflicting pain and fear onto their young lives. Word soon got around about an overweight man who cruised the streets in a brand new black Oldsmobile. One boy later stated how he got into the car of a big burly man who had driven him to a house on Summerdale Avenue in West Norwood. He said that his first meeting with the man was uneventful, but on their second meeting, he was violently beaten. The boy fought back, but he was overpowered and molested anyway. The boy, however, did manage to escape by telling the man his friend had taken down his license plate number for protection. This lie potentially saved his life. But word was out, and rumours of a chubby man and the black Oldsmobile had spread. He was to be avoided at all costs. He was known to be generous with his money, which tempted some boys who were literally living on the breadline. But they knew he was dangerous. Billy Carroll Jr. was the kind of boy who seemed to always be getting into trouble. At the age of 9, he was in a juvenile home for stealing a purse, and at age 11, he was caught with a gun. Billy was mischievous and spent most of his time on the streets of uptown Chicago, hustling. At the age of 16, he was making money by arranging meetings between teenage homosexual boys and adult clientele for a commission, effectively pimping his friends. On June 13, 1976, Billy left his home to head out to the streets, but he never returned. Another victim of Gacy, who was found 2 years later buried in the crawlspace beneath Gacy's home. After murdering Billy, Gacy went on to kill a further 3 boys in a 4-week period. His bloodlust was intensifying. The slain were aged between 16 and 28 years old, although the older man was sadly never identified, so his age is approximate. On August the 5th, a 16-year-old Minnesota boy named James Hansen phoned his family, possibly from Gacy's home. They would never hear from him again. Heartbreakingly, his body was later found buried in Gacy's crawlspace. The body of a 17-year-old Rick Johnson, who was last seen alive on August the 6th, was also later found in the crawlspace. 2 innocent young boys stolen in quick succession, just a day apart. On October the 24th, Gacy abducted and killed teenage friends Kenneth Parker and Michael Marino. The 2 were last seen outside a restaurant on Clark Street in Chicago. 2 days later, a 19-year-old construction worker named William Bundy disappeared after informing his family that he was attending a party. William worked for Gacy, and his body was later found beneath Gacy's bedroom. It is thought that between August and October that Gacy continued to kill, although no bodies could be identified from this period. Gacy, as we previously mentioned, was known to also work out of state, however. 1976 was a time when there was no cell phones or internet. It wasn't unusual for parents not to hear from their children for longer periods of time that would be considered normal by today's standards. This played to Gacy's advantage, sadly, and indeed many other prolific serial killers of this time. There were, however, several accusations similar to the disappearance of John Butkovich, where parents and friends were persistent in their belief that it was out of character for their loved one to just disappear or be classed as a runaway. One such victim was 17-year-old Gregory Godzik. Gregory was a good-looking and well-liked boy who liked nothing better than hanging out with his friends and girlfriend. He was delighted when, towards the end of 1976, he landed an after-school job with PDM Contractors, meaning he would finally have enough money to fix up his old car. Things seemed to be going well for the young man. However, in the early hours of December the 12th, 1976, just after dropping his girlfriend home, Greg disappeared. It was completely out of character for Greg not to contact his parents or his girlfriend to let them know his whereabouts. Even staying out all night was something that Greg never did. It just wasn't in his character. His parents were so worried that they contacted all of his friends and his girlfriend, but none of them knew where he was. When they contacted the police, they were told he was probably a runaway, which seemed to be the standard response to every missing person in the 1960s and 70s. Greg's parents were not willing to accept this, however. The following afternoon, Greg's 1966 maroon Pontiac car was found unlocked and abandoned behind a pet shop in the village of Niles, Illinois. Greg's mother remembered that Gacy owed his son some money for work that he had done and contacted him to see if he had heard from Greg requesting the money. Gacy told her son had called a few days after he disappeared and left a message on his answering machine saying he would be in for work the next day. But when Mrs. Godzik asked to hear the recording, Gacy claimed that he had already erased it. After the conversation, Mrs. Godzik urged the Chicago police to speak to Gacy about her missing son. Considering Gacy had been interviewed about the disappearance of John Butkovich, you would assume a line of inquiry would be made at the very least. However, Greg lived in police area number 5, whereas John lived in police area number 6. And in a pre-digital age, where paper and files were the standard of recording and keeping data, there was simply no standard communication between the two police divisions. Thus, no common link was identified by the Chicago police. Greg's parents later hired a private investigator by the name of Anthony Palo Santo, who had a great reputation for finding runaway kids. But sadly, even he could not find any trace of Greg. Less than 2 months after Greg disappeared, 19-year-old John Sizek was reported missing. He was an acquaintance of both Godzik and Butkovich. Again, John Sizek, like those before him, had no reason to run away, and it would have been completely out of character for him to do so. Infuriatingly, the link was again missed by the police. In one specific area of the same county, over an incredibly short span of time, a large number of teenage boys who all fit the same profile were disappearing one by one, and the police failed to even see that it was happening before their very eyes. Gacy turned out to be in possession of John Sizek's car, but he managed to fob the police off, saying that he had sold it to him because he needed money to leave town. Gobsmackingly, the police accepted this story and made no further inquiries. By the end of 1977, Gacy had murdered 6 more young men. The first of these victims was 18-year-old University of Illinois student Robert Gilroy. Gilroy lived just 4 blocks away from Gacy, and he was the son of a Chicago police sergeant. On September the 15th, 1977, he was expected to catch a bus along with some other students for a day of horseback riding. Robert never showed up. He was immediately reported missing by his parents. At the time, Gacy was in Pittsburgh and did not return to Chicago until September the 16th, however. When Robert's body was eventually found, along with Gacy's other victims in the crawl space under the house, it prompted speculation that maybe Gacy had an accomplice. After all, he was out of town when Robert vanished. However, despite Gacy having several young men stay at his house for long periods of time, police could find no evidence that he had an accomplice. Although going by the police's track record up until this point, this isn't saying much, but that's just my personal opinion. 10 days after Robert disappeared, 19-year-old former US Marine John Mowery vanished after leaving his mother's house to walk to his apartment. Mowery was later found strangled and buried beneath the master bedroom of Gacy's house. 21-year-old Russell Nelson disappeared on October the 17th, 1977. He was from Minnesota and had traveled to Chicago looking for work. He was last seen outside a bar in the city. Less than 4 weeks later, Gacy murdered 16-year-old teenager Robert Winch and buried him in the crawlspace. On November the 18th, 20-year-old father of one Tommy Bailing disappeared after leaving a Chicago bar. He would sadly be another victim found within Gacy's crawlspace. As Christmas approached, Gacy killed another teenage boy, David Talzma, who was traveling to a rock concert in Hammond when he disappeared. On December the 30th, 1977, Gacy abducted 19-year-old student Robert Donnelly from a Chicago bus stop, this time at gunpoint. Gacy drove Robert to his home, where he raped, tortured, and repeatedly dunked his head into a bathtub full of water until he passed out. Throughout the ordeal, Gacy taunted Robert with seemingly plainful statements such as, "Are we playing fun games tonight?" Robert was so traumatized he actually asked Gacy to kill him. However, after several hours of torture, he drove Robert to his workplace and released him, warning him that if he complained to police, they would just not believe him anyway. Ignoring the threat, Robert did report the assault to the police. They actually questioned Gacy on January 6, 1978. Gacy told the police that he was in a sex-slave relationship with Robert, but insisted it was entirely consensual. Remarkably, the police believed Gacy and filed no charges. The effect that this and previous crimes that he got away with must have propelled Gacy's ego into the stratosphere, with him believing that he was untouchable. The following month, Gacy went on to kill 19-year-old William Kindred, who disappeared on February the 16th. By now, the crawl space under Gacy's house was rammed full of bodies, and William was to be the final victim that he buried there. The odour in Gacy's home must have been unbearable, and why it wasn't detected by neighbours is just another staggering element to this story, that if it wasn't true, you would simply never believe it. On March 21st, Gacy lured 26-year-old Jeffrey Rignall into his car. Shortly after Rignall entered the vehicle, Gacy chloroformed him and drove him back to his house. Gacy restrained his arms and head, and a pillory device he called the Rock was affixed to the ceiling. Gacy raped and tortured Rignall with various implements and repeatedly chloroformed him into unconsciousness. After the ordeal, Gacy drove him to Chicago's Lincoln Park, where he was dumped unconscious but still alive. Rignall managed to stagger to his girlfriend's apartment, and police were informed of the assault. At first, the police didn't investigate Gacy, as Rignall had few details apart from the make of car that Gacy had, and at this point, why bother doing their job anyway? He was so severely injured, he spent 6 days in hospital. However, Rignall was determined to get justice for his ordeal, and he and his friends staked out the area near where he was picked up at Lincoln Park. Eventually, they spotted Gacy's black car cruising, so they followed him back to his home at 8213 West Summerdale Avenue. Armed with his new information, he provided police with a license plate number and Gacy's address, but they still did not act on the information. I'm absolutely gobsmacked at this juncture. Anyway, back to it. By the time police took Rignall's account seriously, Gacy had already been arrested on murder charges. By 1978, the crawl space was jammed with bodies, yet still no one had a clue, and Gacy was still considered by most people as a good neighbor and civic hero. He even moved a new girlfriend in and declared to his next-door neighbor that he was getting married yet again for the third time. The relationship didn't last, however, and few people actually even met her. Honestly, I'm surprised she wasn't asphyxiated by the stink of rotting bodies in Gacy's house, to be honest. Gacy was still picking up teenagers and killing them, but because he had run out of space under his house, he started disposing of his victims by throwing them off the I-55 bridge into the Des Plaines River. Gacy later confessed to throwing 5 bodies into the river in 1978, and he believed one had actually landed on a passing barge. Only 4 bodies were ever found, though. Robert Pest was only 15 years old when he mysteriously vanished. At the time, Pest was working in a pharmacy. His mother had come to pick him up after his shift and was waiting in the shop. Robert told her to wait a few minutes as he needed to go outside to talk to a contractor who had offered him a job. Robert never returned. 3 hours after Robert's disappearance, the Des Plaines Police Department was notified of the disappearance, and Lieutenant Joseph Kozenczak started an investigation. After learning the name of the contractor who had offered the job to Robert, the lieutenant knocked on Gacy's door. Gacy answered, and Detective Kozenczak told him about the missing boy. He asked Gacy to go with him to the police station for questioning. Gacy said he was unable to leave his home at the moment because there was a recent death in the family and he had to attend some phone calls, but said he would come down to the station later. This was surprisingly agreed to. Gacy showed up to the police station at 3:20 a.m. He was covered in mud, claiming that he had been involved in a car accident. Detective Kazanzak was not at the station at the time, so Gacy was asked to return during office hours. On returning to the police station later that day, he denied any involvement in the recent disappearance. At the request of detectives, Gacy prepared a written statement detailing his movements on December the 11th. Detective Kozenzak decided to run a background check on Gacy and was surprised to find that he had served time for committing sodomy on a teenager years earlier. Soon after, Detective Kozenzak obtained a search warrant for Gacy's house. The first search of Gacy's property took place on December the 13th, 1978. The search revealed several suspicious items. Amongst them were police badges, a 6mm Brevet Larter starter pistol, a syringe and hypodermic needle. Investigators also found handcuffs, books on homosexuality and pederasty titled Pretty Boys Must Die, pornographic films, capsules of amyl nitrate, bottles of Valium and atropine, several driver's licenses, child's underwear, and an 18-inch dildo. In one of the bedrooms, they found a class of 1975 West High School ring engraved with the initials JAS, alongside a 36-inch section of nylon rope and a receipt from the Nissan pharmacy, the same pharmacy where Robert Pest worked. The crawl space located beneath Gacy's home was searched, and the first thing that struck investigators was a rancid odor that they believed to be sewage. The earth in the crawl space was sprinkled with lime, but seemed to have been untouched. Police found nothing else during the first search of the crawl space. Gacy was enraged that the police had searched his property and immediately contacted his lawyer. When Gacy was presented with a Miranda waiver stating his rights and asked to sign it, he refused. Police had nothing to arrest him on and eventually had to release him. After more questioning about Pest's disappearance, however, they confiscated Gacy's vehicle and other work vehicles and put him under 24-hour surveillance. The police finally began to piece together other complaints and investigations against Gacy, and things started coming together for them, although they didn't yet have enough to arrest him on. Gacy himself was getting restless. Initially, he joked around with the surveillance police and even brought them takeouts. But soon he started accusing them of harassing him. A further examination of Gacy's vehicle was conducted, and investigators discovered a small cluster of fibers which may have been human hair. That evening, officers conducted a test using three trained German Shepherd search dogs to determine whether Pest had been present in any of Gacy's vehicles. One dog approached Gacy's Oldsmobile and lay on the passenger seat in what the dog's handler informed investigators was a death reaction, indicating Pest's body had been present in the vehicle. During the days following the police search of Gacy's house, some of his friends were called into the police station and interrogated. From the interviews, police gathered little information on any connection between Gacy and Robert Pest, and friends of Gacy could not believe that he was capable of killing a teenage boy. Unknown to police at the time, Gacy had recently confided in a friend and co-worker a day before his arrest that he had indeed killed a gay man. He also told him that he had killed several people because they were bad and trying to blackmail him. On Friday, December the 22nd, 1978, Gacy finally and matter-of-factly confessed to police that he had killed at least 30 people and buried most of the remains of his victims beneath the crawl space of his house. He also admitted to sometimes keeping the dead bodies under his bed or in the attic for several hours before eventually burying them. Police set about digging. It was not long before they discovered a suspicious mound of earth. As they started to dig, the distinctive smell of death was all around, and they were about to make a horrific discovery. Carefully, they began excavating body after body after body, some decomposing and some skeletal. The body count grew. Some of the victims were found with their underwear still lodged deep in their throats. The victims were buried so close together that police believed they were probably killed or buried at the same time, but Gacy later confirmed to police that he had on several occasions killed more than one person in a single day. However, the reason he gave for them being buried so close together was simply that he was running out of room and needed to conserve space. By the 28th of December 1978, police had removed a total of 27 bodies from Gacy's house. However, this was not the final death count. They had also linked the death of Frank Landigen, whose body had been found in the Des Plaines River, to Gacy, after Frank's driver's license was found in Gacy's home, as well as James Mazzara, who was also found with the all-too-familiar underwear lodged in his throat. By the end of February 1979, police were still digging up Gacy's property. They had completely gutted the house, but believed there were still more bodies to be found. They were right. While workmen were breaking up the concrete of Gacy's patio, they came across another horrific discovery. They found the body of a man still in a well-preserved condition in the concrete. He appeared to be sleeping. The man wore a pair of blue denim shorts and a wedding ring. Gacy's victims no longer included just young boys. The following week, another body was discovered. The 31st body to be found linked to Gacy was in the Illinois River. Investigators were able to discover the identity of the young man by a tattoo on one of his arms. The victim's name was Timothy O'Rourke. Another body was found in Gacy's property. The body was located beneath the recreation room of Gacy's house. It would be the last body to be found on John Wayne Gacy's property. The house was destroyed and reduced to rubble soon after the police investigation was completed. The search for the dead had finally come to an end, but investigations were far from over as they tried to identify each of the victims. All but nine of the victims were eventually identified, however. On Wednesday, February 6, 1980, John Wayne Gacy's murder trial began in the Cook County Criminal Courts building in Chicago, Illinois. Jury members consisted of five women and seven men. They listened as prosecutor Bob Egan talked about Robert Peth's life and his gruesome death, and how Gacy was responsible for his murder and the violent murders of 32 other young men. The trial lasted for five grueling weeks, during which horrific details were revealed about Gacy's thrill killings. Some of his friends and neighbors spoke of a kind and generous man. The darker side of his life and temper were also exposed, and those who survived Gacy's attacks told the harrowing tales of the torture that he put them through. Testimony from Jeffrey Rignall was quickly ended after he broke down while telling the court the details of his rape. Rignall began to vomit and cry hysterically. He was eventually removed from the courthouse as Gacy looked on emotionless. Over 100 witnesses would testify in the trial. Then the jury were left to make their final decision. It only took 2 hours of deliberation before the jury came back with its final verdict. We, the jury, find the defendant, John Wayne Gacy, guilty. Gacy was found guilty in the deaths of all 33 young men and was convicted of more murders than anyone else in American history. Gacy was sentenced to receive the death penalty for each murder that he committed and was sent to Maynard Correctional Center. On the morning of May the 9th, 1994, Gacy was transferred to Stateville Correctional Center to be executed. He was allowed a private picnic on the prison grounds with his family, where he dined on a bucket of KFC, a dozen fried shrimp, French fries, fresh strawberries, and a Diet Coke, all at his request. Gacy was then escorted to the Statesville execution chamber to receive a lethal injection. He walked calmly to his death, showed no remorse, and showed no emotion. Before the execution began, the chemicals used to carry out the execution unexpectedly solidified, clogging the IV line used to administer the chemicals into Gacy's arm. After 10 minutes, the execution resumed. Gacy, in a statement to his lawyer just prior to his execution, stated that killing him would not compensate for the loss of others, and the state was actually murdering him. his final spoken words were "kiss my ass." A crowd of over 1,000 people gathered outside. Following Gacy's death, his brain was removed and is still in the possession of Helen Morrison, a witness for the defense in Gacy's trial. Morrison had interviewed Gacy in an attempt to identify common personality traits of violent sociopaths. The rest of his body was cremated. Given how Gacy was known to travel to work in other states, it is speculated that his body count is significantly higher to what is known. We will never know the true number of lives that he took. There is still ongoing research and private investigations as to whether Gacy had accomplices or was part of a wider sex ring. There is circumstantial evidence linking Gacy to Dean Corll, Robin Gecht, and Edward Spitzer, in addition to the Franklin scandal of the late 1980s. But as I said, this is purely circumstantial at this stage. For the friends and families of Gacy's victims, their torment will never end. Neither will those that survived his evil clutches. But may his victims find comfort, solace, and salvation, and may they rest eternally in peace.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.